Albina Ruiz. Zahir Amunajed. Our moderator, Kamal Dervish. Ladies and gentlemen, our working group chair, Gail Smith.
I'm going to sing. It's like, okay. I'm going to be very brief. Our lunch went over. I just want to let those of you who are new here know how this works. This is an interactive discussion. So we're going to hear from our panel. And then you see these people and table facilitators and computers at all of your tables. We have this magical thing that happens that the discussion reverts to your tables. It is all fed into some great system and smart people in the back of the room who work it and translate it back to us, and then we'll have a reaction from our panel. Meanwhile, while the panel is running during this first 30 minutes, if you have questions that come up, pass them to the person with the computer, and we will try to address some of that in the second round. But again, we're going to want to hear from you in this. Very briefly, for those of you who were at lunch, our last speaker said that ending poverty can be spelled one way, J-O-B-S. That's what this panel is about. We have a fantastic panel and a tremendous moderator, a man who has worked on poverty and economics his whole life, in many ways a great personal friend. So it's my honor and my pleasure to turn it over to our moderator, Kamal Dervish.
Thank you very much, Gail. Thank you so much. It's a great pleasure to be here, to sense all this friendship and energy, positive energy. And we have a fantastic panel. I'm going to introduce them very briefly in a minute. Let me just start by saying at the United Nations Development Program and in many other places, at the World Bank also, where I worked many years, fighting poverty is the first priority. But it's very clear what Gail just said. Fighting poverty, above all, is creating jobs. Because if you want to fight poverty in a sustainable way, in a way that lasts, handing out payments, food, whatever, to sustain people, sometimes you have to do it in war, after a war, in conflict, and, you know, during a terrible humanitarian disaster, earthquakes or whatever. And that's essential, humanitarian action, to help people stay alive. But in the long run, what counts is productive jobs, jobs that actually produce things, good services that are consumed, that are in demand in the market. And that's the only way in the long run to fight poverty in a way that lasts. So that's why I fully agree. Jobs, jobs, jobs. That's what it's all about. And we have people who have done very specific things. We want to share that with you. We've been successful, very successful. We're scaling up. But I think who need our support and we need their ideas. We need to, in what we do, we need to share these ideas. So let me again welcome William Bissell, Chief Executive Officer of Fabinia, founded in 1960, to market the vast and diverse craft traditions of India. Its products are sourced from villages all over India, thereby helping to provide and sustain rural employment and linking the rural economy to the urban economy and to the world economy. Fabinia seeks to bring aesthetic and affordable products to today's consumers. Fabinia has also a very important partnership with a big Indian bank, the ICICI Bank, and William will tell us more about that. Thanks to that partnership, there are now community-owned companies with a target of 100,000 artisan shareholders throughout India. We have Albina Ruiz, Executive Director of Ciudad Saludable of Peru. 20 years ago, Albina came up with the idea for developing efficient solid waste management system that generate employment and contribute to better quality of life and cleaner cities. In addition to taking care of that problem, Albina's micro-enterprise model provides self-employment opportunities to local residents in the most difficult neighborhoods. Working in partnership with municipalities since 2002, Ciudad Saludable has created 320 direct jobs and 5,000 indirectly, reaching the poor and rural communities. Of course, the target is much larger. Albina's simple idea has become a successful business and community organization model, and she will share her experience with us. Zahir Al-Munajid is chairman of the Grameen Jamil Microfinance Limited in Saudi Arabia, as well as advisor to Mohammed Abdul Latif Jamil, president of ALG Company in Saudi Arabia. In these positions, Zahir is at the forefront of implementing Mohammed Jamil's vision of job creation through both microfinance and vocational training. And I think he really is showing one of the most effective ways of fighting poverty in the Arab world. There is a special emphasis here also on women, on employment of women through microfinance, and the program in Saudi Arabia today serves over 10,000 women across the country. He will tell us more about that. So let us start with Zahir. Can you tell us how you combine microfinance with vocational training, the particular difficulties with women, but maybe first telling us about the scale of the problem you're facing in the region?
Hello. I represent a multi-billion company from the Arab world. And having your backyard in the Arab world is a major problem. Around you, the environment is not, in general, very healthy. We are talking about a population of around 300 million people, where more than 60% are young, below 20. We are talking about unemployment. The need for jobs is approximately, from some statistics I saw, over 30 million jobs over the next 20 years. We are talking about poverty, where approximately 70 to 80 million people live on less than $2 a day. So for anybody from the area who cares about his society, who cares about his community, who cares about basically passing on a business to his kids, one has to look at what's happening around you. So the Jamil Group started some years back looking at that, starting training people to hire them within the company, then found that, yes, training is good, but we can't hire all the people in the marketplace. So we have to train people and try to match them with jobs somewhere else. So we started to match jobs and skills. We'd go to a restaurant and say, you need cooks, Saudi cooks? Good, we'll send them, we'll train them. Our expense, you take them. That was the first step. We went and said, okay, we have a lot of unemployed Saudis. Let's give them cars. We're in the car business. Let's give them taxis at good rates. We won't make a profit. We put an ad in the paper. The first ad requested 25 applicants. We got 2,000. That program today is very successful, and we've given out more than 600 loans of cars and small trucks. We started creating training centers, vocational training for technicians. Car distributors in Saudi today have approximately 10,000 positions for mechanics. These positions are all filled with expatriates. There are very few Saudis who want to do the job. We got together all the car distributors, got the Japanese manufacturers, got the Saudi government, got the Japanese government, put the money in, created a center managed by the private sector that today churns 200 young technicians a year, and they are taken on the spot because they have jobs waiting for them. That was very interesting because it could be replicated. We then went to the hospitals because all health staff in Saudi are foreign. We started doing a hospital school and got all the hospitals together, did the same thing. We did the same thing for electronics, and we did the same thing for building contractors. But still, there was a lot to be done. We had not approached women. We had not approached the poorest women in Saudi. I'm still talking about Saudi. Maybe I'll expand beyond that. In Saudi, basically, because of social restriction, traditional restrictions and not legal restrictions, there's a lot of women that were left on the sides. We started a program with Grameen. This program today provides microfinance, and we've reached over 10,000 women. That program was the base to start a pan-Arab program that end of this year will reach 200,000 women through our partners. We have 11 partners across the Arab world. We provide capacity building, and we provide financing. We have a fund, a guarantee fund of $50 million for that sake, and we hope to reach by 2011 a million borrowers.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Zahir. And, you know, we have to remember something that it's hard to believe sometimes, but in many big cities in the developing countries, about half of the young people have no prospects for jobs at all. I'm not, you know, not everywhere, that's not the average, but in the big cities, among the big neighborhoods, the poorest neighborhoods, you have about half the young people with absolutely no job prospects. And, you know, what that is in terms of challenge for security, for stability, is just huge. So what you're doing is absolutely critical. Albina, you have focused on one particular problem, and then you've gone from there to develop social entrepreneurship to try to make these things sustainable in your country and also looking towards the whole of Latin America. So tell us more about it.
In the first time, I want to say I'm social entrepreneur, fellow from Ashoka. Ciudad Saludable, in Spanish, healthy city in English, working in Peru in the first time, but now we're working in six countries in Latin America. We develop waste management projects in poor cities in Peru, in 50 cities now, in agreement with the local municipalities. We generate employment, formalizing waste scavengers. Then the creation of microenterprises for the collection, recycling, treatment, and final disposal of waste. Up until the year 2000, recycling activities done by waste scavengers was illegal. We promote the National Solid Waste Law. Today, all municipalities in Peru must formalize the waste scavengers as a part of their solid waste program. Ciudad Saludable measures its impact through a methodology called social return or investment analysis, SROA, help us to monetize our impact and different levels, environmental, economic, and social. This tool has become very important for our expansion in other Latin American countries. I tell you a history. 10 years ago, I met a woman, Sonia Quispe, and her mothers, who made a living of collecting waste from a dump to feed her pigs. Sonia created a micro-enterprise collection, and today she employed 12 other women who manufacture bags from recycling materials. She is very successful that she is now exporting these products to Mexico. For our work, of course, we need to work with many stakeholders, the local government, the regional government, the national government, because we need to promote the new law, the new regulation. But we need with the private sector too. They have a social responsibility program, any companies. But now they are a good strategic partners for us. Of course, for us it's very important working in environmental education. Our strategy is door-to-door. We're mobilizing more than 300 young volunteers. They help us talk door-to-door and explain, please, you separated your garbage, because if you separate it, it's better for the recycling families of course, for you, because after that you pay less tax. We training the teachers in the school. After that, they teach the students. The students teach the parents in home. It's the cycling. For us, it's not possible our work if we don't work with the social leaders. For us, this is more important partnership. I say all the time, probably we can a lot of money, best technology, but if the community don't participate, it is not sustainable.
Thank you very much. Now, William, you know, India is a giant, and it used to be when I was in graduate school, it was this huge economy growing very slowly. Now it's growing by leaps and bounds, and indeed is, I think, part of the reason in terms of looking at the world economy that we're not as worried by the various financial problems that appear here and there, is that there are now in the world economy many drivers of growth, not just the U.S. or not just Japan. But, you know, even if there's a slowdown in the U.S., China and India are now big enough, not to carry it all by themselves, but to contribute tremendously to the growth of the world economy and to the stability of the world economy. At the same time, there's still tremendous poverty in India. There's a big divide between the cities and the rural areas, I think. And you are addressing precisely that divide, working to get rural area products to the cities. You're working with the financial institutions, you're scaling up that approach, and I think what you're doing there is so needed in so many other countries. I've seen it in many dynamic emerging market economies, that while there are the dynamically growing sectors, there are other parts of the country, including in my own, for example, in Turkey, where employment is absolutely stagnant, where nothing is happening. So you have a tremendous duality, very dynamic parts of the economy and then other parts not moving. And I think, William, you're linking these. You're trying to use the dynamic part to help the rural side. So tell us about your experiences.
Thank you, Kamal. I think you put it very eloquently in when you said that, like Turkey, India has two parts to it. There's this dynamic growth engine, which is pulling about 120 million people at an extraordinary speed. If you take away the rest of the country, the 120 million, the economy that surrounds them is probably growing at something around 20%. The economy that surrounds the balance billion people is not in such good shape. And if you get a sense of a country which has got 120 million people going at an extraordinary speed, consuming, investing, that's what's appearing on the global radar screen as rapid growth. Unfortunately, it's like since independence, if you view India as a train, the first two carriages took off with the engine, leaving the rest of the train sort of just outside the railway station. And I use this analogy because the rest of the world today, I mean, there's a lot of hype in New York about India at 60 and India shining, and the rest of the world is focused on that engine and the two cars right behind it. The problem that will happen if the rest of the engine or the rest of the train doesn't get hitched back onto that engine is the very forces that India has unleashed by embracing free markets is in danger of being lost as the rest of the country looks at capitalism and says this is a terrible idea. What's being called into question across villages in India, the company I run works in 285 of India's 611 administrative regions. Most businesses one hears about in India are urban-centric. They work in Bangalore, which is where the IT hub of India is, or in Bombay, which is the financial hub of the country. The rest of the country, in large parts, is a sort of a black hole. where the rule of law is rapidly deteriorating as communities question the whole premise of the government. In the days of socialism, we had a 2% growth rate, but it was there was also a very, very small increase in people's aspirations. So there was general social stability, even though we had incredibly low economic growth. What's happened now is with rising aspirations, if the economy is not able to translate those aspirations into something resembling a change in people's lives, and that's the percent, that's the 1 billion who are not in the fast-growing group, the fast-growing country is going to rapidly lose its initiative and momentum. Just as I was leaving to come here, one of the largest retail efforts in this country has been blocked. Every store that Reliance, which is India's sort of flagship industry, is opening has been picketed, closed. People are angry because they feel that capitalism hasn't delivered to them. What we have seen and what we have tried to do over the last 4 years has been to show people in rural India the benefits of capitalism. India has been the home of many great missionary movements. People have come to India to spread very different kinds of words. But I think one of the things we need today is a movement to bring capitalism, and that is corporations in which the artisans, in our case, and other rural communities are stakeholders. There's a need to do this because without that, that engine, which is really an extraordinary engine, the engine of what we call capitalism, that the benefits of that engine are going to be lost to a majority of the population. So in our personal example, what we have tried to do is we have a rapidly growing retail business in urban India. And as Kamal has said, we've tried to make a bridge with that engine, and source all our sourcing is done from these rural communities. So wherever we have been traditionally sourcing, and we have deep roots in rural India, we have been collecting our artisans, not into cooperatives, which was the original socialist model that was followed, but into profit-making companies. We've had to fight government in this because the government has made it very, very difficult through a series of laws to actually make small shareholders members of unlisted companies. They have forced everybody to go the listed route. So we've had a series of meetings with government, which have been pretty unsuccessful. But in spite of that, we've managed to create a model whereby we have asked people to invest. The minimum investment is $2.50 to buy a share in your local community-owned company. We have guaranteed that community-owned company space in each of our retail stores by giving them a certain amount of rack space. So they have, as Kamal said, they have now a bridge to take their product to retail markets, not only in India, but also in other parts of the world where we have stores. In doing so, we're hoping that as their products sell in those stores, we will continue to purchase their goods, and those goods will be marketed by those community-owned companies, some of whom have a shareholding of around, the average shareholding is about 1,200, 1,000 to 1,200 shareholders per community-owned company. We've had trouble convincing the regulatory authorities of how we will conduct valuations of these companies because they're not listed. And then once we've done that, how we will actually provide for exits to the shareholders in the event that they want to actually sell their share. And the whole experiment has hinged on actually one small detail, which is that having created a valuation methodology, and we've got some very smart chartered accountants, India's full of very smart chartered accountants, to work out a valuation methodology. We then had to figure out how to give rural artisans, because by the end of 2009, we should have 100,000 rural artisans. We had to figure out a way of how to give those guys exits when they're ready to cash in their equity. Remember, these companies are not publicly traded. The cost, our original plan, sorry, I'll be very short. So in short, it took 3 years working with one of the most innovative financial institutions in the country, the ICICI Bank, to work out a method by which we could actually provide liquidity when each of those people needed it. And the result of it has been that every community we've been going into has welcomed the community-owned companies and has voted by often 10 to 1. Our subscription rates in some cases are between 8 and 10 to 1. So each of these companies is oversubscribed to that extent. And if any of you are coming to India and would like, since we're in the spirit of making commitments, and would like to see some of these communities, I can give you my email address, and we can make sure that you get to visit one of these community-owned companies to see what's actually happening on the ground, and hopefully you will feel inspired by that. The email address you need is w.bissell@fabindia.com. So if any of you are traveling to India, I would extend, you know, the community-owned companies are there. We will organize for you to visit one of them that's closest to where you're going. They're all over the country. And you'll see firsthand what I've been talking about. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, here's a challenge and an invitation. And, of course, as you all know, you're encouraged now to enter your questions into the computers. And we'll come back. I think we've run out of time. We were planning a kind of second round. But we'll come back after to face the questions and try to get the answers. I think the analogy to the train with the two wagons and the rest of the train, you know, is a very good one. I think in the Middle East, one could also say, you know, the huge oil wealth on the one side taking off and oil price going through the roof. And yet in Cairo, in Sana'a, in many other cities, you know, lots, millions of poor young people without any job prospects. So that vision of some part of the train moving fast and the other one not moving at all is the challenge we all face. I think we're now going back to our round table here. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And as we move around, as Kamal says, now it turns over to you. And I think, again, keeping this analogy of the train in mind, what we want to focus on is those other cars. And on the issue of jobs, we'd like to ask you at your tables to consider two very simple but important questions. The first is, if job creation is our goal, what are the two or three actions that governments, industry, and NGOs should take? And I would encourage you to be a little bit out of the box. I mean, we all know they need to create the right environment, invest in people, support entrepreneurs. But thinking about CGI and the kinds of stories we told at lunch or the kinds of things you and others have done, what can those sectors do? The second is a little bit harder, though it sounds simple, and that is, what can an individual do? What is possible for an individual to do if you want to help create jobs, if you do believe, as I think our panelists have demonstrated, that is, in fact, the key to alleviating poverty? So we're going to turn you loose with our table facilitators, who are good folks. They know what they're doing. They know the issues. Please feel free to voice your opinions. And as I say, we'll have this magical process where it's all translated, and then we'll bring the panel back up. The floor is now yours.